In Michael Kinsley's new collection of political and social essays, he writes this: "The short attention span of Americans is a continuous blessing for journalists and politicians. We can whip up a nice froth of hysteria on any subject we wish without much fear that the audience will complain, 'Wait a minute, we're still hysterical over the matter you were importuning us about last month.'" Well, Kinsley whips up his readers on a weekly basis with his TRB column in The New Republic. Kinsley is also the editor of The New Republic. He's a former editor of Harper's and is credited with being the individual most responsible for that magazine's recovery. His new collection of essays is titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. His fellow journalist, Christopher Hitchens, calls Kinsley a master of ridicule and a foe of sentimentality. I spoke with Michael Kinsley earlier today from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Kinsley took over the TRB column in 1983 from Richard Strout, who had written it for over 40 years and retired at the age of 85. I asked Kinsley why he kept the TRB byline instead of changing it to his own.
Well, it's a great advantage to inherit one, of course. You know, it had a following, it had a tradition. Dick Strout had been doing it for 43 years, and I have friends who've tried to start a column, and it's far more difficult.
Do you think of yourself as fitting neatly into any political categories of, you know, liberal, conservative, neoconservative, neoliberal?
Oh, well, I think I'm basically a liberal, and I'm associated with people like my former boss, Charlie Peters, who's editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who call themselves neoliberals. As I say in this book, I consider myself a liberal, but I don't consider it important enough to get into a fight with people who don't think I deserve the label.
Do you think that most people want to know how you define yourself so that they can decide in advance whether or not they agree with you?
Oh, I think that's part of it. I don't take the position, the snotty position a lot of people have that, oh, labels are unimportant. I think labels are very important. They're very useful. And I think you can give the words liberal and conservative and even neoliberal do have meaning and are worth trying to apply. But I think that there are going to be exceptions. No one is going to fit the label perfectly.
So, defining yourself as a liberal, why don't you define liberal?
Well, I think a liberal is a person who believes in domestic social policy matters and in an activist role for the central government, the federal government. I think the difference between a neoliberal and a paleoliberal, as you might call them, is that a neoliberal is skeptical about many government programs we have now. But unlike, say, a neoconservative who used to be a liberal and now thinks it's all rubbish, a neoliberal is someone who says, look, there are better ways of doing things, but the principle that the government needs to play an active role in preventing poverty and in managing the economy is that's a neoliberal.
But you think of yourself as a liberal, not a neoliberal?
Oh, no, I don't mind. I mean, the problem with the term neoliberal is not that I disagree with it. It's become a marketing term for a lot of people who feel very strongly they want to push this label. I'm not particularly of that school. But I'm happy enough if someone wants to call me a neoliberal, sure.
I'm sure your pieces really upset a lot of your readers.
I hope so.
The pieces that you've written, which is the one that's upset the liberals the most and which has upset conservatives the most?
I think the one that upset the liberals the most of the pieces in this book was a book review I wrote of Jonathan Schell's The Fate of the Earth. It's very hard to recall now, but at the time that book was published in 1982, and it ran originally in The New Yorker, it was treated rapturously. It was as if all life on Earth must stop in order to appreciate the importance of this book. One reviewer actually wrote that Knopf, the publishing firm, the publisher, should cancel the rest of its list for that year so that everyone would only read this book. I wrote, I believe, the first negative review of this book, which struck me as extremely silly.
Do you want to explain the basic premise of the book for
the basic premise? The basic premise of the book was nuclear war is this awful, awful thing, and it was the sort of flagship book of the anti-nuclear movement, which I think accomplished a lot of very good things. I don't think we'd be having President Reagan would be on the verge of signing an arms control treaty today if it hadn't been for the people he has nothing good to say about who were campaigning for it back in the early 80s. However, this book took as its premise that nuclear weapons must be wiped off the face of the earth, that that any other consideration, such as protecting our freedoms, was irrelevant in the face of the ultimate peril. And it was just a bunch of, I read it in absolute astonishment, thinking this is this overheated rhetoric, completely nonsensical, and everyone was greeting it as if it was, a new book of the Bible. And when I wrote that, I got a lot of extremely hostile response from liberals, including my boss at that time, the chairman of the board of Harper's. And but I think the world has come around to my point of view on Jonathan Schell. I think that book and that whole episode is hardly ever remembered today, whereas back at the time, everyone was virtually certain that this was going to be recalled as one of the towering books of our century.
What about the piece that got conservatives most upset?
I have to look at the table of contents here. I guess it would be The Case for Glee, which was something I wrote less than a year ago, last Christmas time, saying it's perfectly all right to say it was about when Reagan was first getting enmeshed in the Iran-Contra scandal, and everyone was saying, oh, this is a terrible tragedy, and I wrote a piece saying, look, it's wonderful, he deserves it.
Is this the piece where you wrote, Reagan's come up and says democracy's salvation?
That's right, and the last lines of it were ha, 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 and that stirred up, I thought, an amazing amount of fuss, considering it was just a little column.
My guest is Michael Kinsley. He's the editor of The New Republic, and he also writes the TRB column, which is syndicated. His new collection of essays is titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. Now, you wrote one piece in which you compared George Bush to a dog that's really learned how to take commands from its master. Have you ever run into George Bush since writing that column?
Well, he's not the kind of person you bump into at the grocery store. No, I don't.
But
think
you go to lots of places besides the grocery
store.
Well,
I don't go to places where I've never met George Bush. And, you know, about a year after I wrote that, George Will, who certainly does run into George Bush in places, wrote a column using the exact same metaphor. I called him a puppy dog, and George Will called him a lap dog. And I'm sure that was it was much more embarrassing for him than it was for me.
Some of your funniest pieces are about journalistic cliches. One piece is about bad headlines that you found, and the title of the piece is Worthwhile Canadian Initiative, which you thought was just the ultra boring headline. And people apparently were sending you in lots of dull headlines after that. Are you still getting bad headlines?
They've tapered off. It's probably time to write another piece to generate some more. But there are certainly no end of them. I got a lot of hostile response from Canadians who felt it was unfair to say that a headline was made boring just because it had the word Canadian in it.
Well, I think the words worthwhile initiative are also,
yeah,
have that the ring of dullness to them.
Well, the whole thing was so sort of terminally high-minded. What could it possibly be, this worthwhile Canadian initiative? It could be anything involving the future of NATO. There are other geographical regions, European unity. It's not just Canada that can be boring.
Do you have any favorites?
Let me look it up in the book. We're slowing things down here while I reread my own book, which I'm enjoying terribly much. Oh, here's one: A Sound Compromise on UN Budgeting. There was a little. My friends at the Washington Post and I exchanged headlines that we think are boring, and then we got into bylines. By Elliot L. Richardson is an especially boring byline. Hyattsville building still closed. Pan Am jumbo jet lands safely. Library group confers on vexing issues. And then tribal fighting in Papua New Guinea. Nothing to worry about, officials say. The best ones are the ones that tell you something going on far away is something you don't really have to think about, which of course you weren't thinking about anyway.
These would be hard to top, I think.
Yeah.
Do you get to write your own headlines for your columns and pieces?
Yeah, well, since I'm the editor, I get to write the headlines for mine and for other people's. But, you know, it's a cooperative effort at the New Republic, and we do our best not to make our headlines boring. Sometimes I think we're sort of misrepresenting articles to our readers by making them sound a little bit more exciting than they might really be. But
example?
Well, I'm not going to give you any examples of
the dull article and the good headline
of the New Republic, but I'll just say that I tell the other editors there when someone says, "Oh, we can't call it that. That's misrepresenting the piece." I said, "The Federal Trade Commission does not investigate false labeling of magazine articles."
You also put down some bad journalistic cliches like "there are no easy answers" and catchphrases like "thoughtful observers say blah blah blah." I guess it's really convenient when you're stuck to pull out a cliche like that. Do you find yourself ever resorting to it?
Oh, I had a frightening episode just this past week where I was talking to the op-ed editor of one of the newspapers that publishes my column, who was saying, "You know, what I really like about your stuff is a lot of people, as they get older, they start issuing pleas for leadership, and you've never done that." And I was just staring at my computer screen where I was just composing, a piece about the budget deficit, which everyone's writing about. And I was about to issue a plea for leadership. So she saved me from that.
You've appeared on several of the Sunday morning talk shows, the news and analysis talk shows. Do each of those shows have a different protocol, a different etiquette book that you have to follow before you get on?
Well, I'm not invited to the ones that show much display of having any etiquette book at all. I mean, I've done McLaughlin Group, which certainly, if there's an etiquette book there, I don't know what it could possibly say.
Unhinge yourself.
And the CNN Crossfire, which is also etiquette is not a word that you think of in connection with that show either.
Well, one of your essays, you said.
I'd be very curious as to what the hoity-toityer shows are like. A couple weeks ago, they let me on to Face the Nation, and I tried to be a bit more polite. But I think they only wanted me because they had Pat Buchanan, and they were hoping to get a little bit less polite.
Let me ask you, do you think that a lot of those shows find it easier to bring on someone from the right than they do to bring on their real counterpart from the left?
I think in a way, I benefit from the fact that all these, the sort of the spectrum of columnists and commentators is definitely skewed to the right. And I think I'm about as far left as you're permitted to get, which in my opinion is not very far left. I mean, I think by any reasonable standards, I'm sort of moderate left. And on this thing I did a couple of weeks ago, for example, they had me against Pat Buchanan. I think on any reasonable drawing of the spectrum, he is a heck of a lot further to the right than I am to the left. And there are people to the left of me who really ought to be balancing out against Pat Buchanan. So I think the people who complain that these shows are tilted to the right have a very valid criticism.
In one of your essays, you write that a gaffe is when a politician tells the truth. Would you explain?
Well, the example there was back from the 1984 campaign. Gary Hart got in terrible trouble when he was still running against Walter Mondale for making a speech saying how glad he was to be in California, or no, how sorry he was that his wife was getting to campaign in California and he was having to campaign in New Jersey. And Walter Mondale made a tremendous stink about this insult to New Jersey. And of course, that was Walter Mondale knew perfectly well that anyone would rather campaign in California than in New Jersey. I'm trying to think, there have been some gaffes already in this campaign, which involves someone saying what everybody, either something that's true or what everybody is widely known to think, only you're not supposed to say it. And then as soon as you say it, everyone else accuses you of saying this terrible thing. For example, we have to cut Social Security, I would say would be a rather serious example of it, that you can't solve the budget deficit without taking a bite out of entitlements. Or, of course, the greatest gaffe of all is we must raise taxes, which every person who has seriously studied the budget knows to be the case, that in order to straighten out the budget deficit, we have to tackle both entitlements on the one hand, such as Social Security, and raise taxes on the other hand. And yet anyone who says that immediately gets trampled upon by all the other candidates who say this is a terrible thing to say. And that is, of course, the ultimate gaffe. But it's a gaffe because it's true.
Yeah, I see your point. My guest is Michael Kinsley, and he's the editor of The New Republic, and he writes the TRB column, which is also syndicated. His new collection of essays is titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. We'll talk more about journalism, politics, and social issues after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Kinsley is my guest. A few years ago, you resigned for about 2 weeks from The New Republic. over a story that you wanted, a story that you didn't write, that another writer wrote, but you were editing, and you wanted it published, and your, was it the publisher who killed it?
Or? Well, it was the editor.
It was the editor, chief, okay.
And also, who happens to be the owner.
Right, okay. There you go. The story, why don't you explain what the story was about?
It was a story, this was in the lead-up, it was 1979, it was the lead-up to the 1980 election, and Edward Kennedy was running for office, and we had a piece by a woman, a feminist, making a feminist argument that that the reports of Kennedy's philandering were a relevant issue for the political campaign and ought to be a subject of debate. And I felt that this was an important matter that should be discussed. And leaving aside what happened back in 1979, this very same issue came up again, of course, with Gary Hart earlier this year, and journalists were pulling their hair out saying, should we be publishing this sort of thing? And my feeling is definitely yes.
Why definitely yes?
Well, you know, there are several reasons. The author of this article made a rather serious one. I have a rather less serious one. It's a question of hypocrisy. And it's not just that Gary Hart said, look, you can follow me around, I'm not having an affair. Every politician paints a picture of his life which he wants the voter to buy, or she. If a politician ever said, look, I don't want anything about my private life in the paper. Therefore, I don't want you to interview my wife. I don't want you to take pictures of me and my children coming out of church. I don't want any reports about my volunteer activities or anything like that. Oh, and also, I don't want you to write about my mistress. I would say, well, that's fine. That's a very consistent position. This guy wants to be judged on the issues. But they don't say that. They want you to write about their wives and children and volunteer activities and how often they go to church. But they don't want you to write about their mistress, so or whatever else they're trying to keep hidden. So what they're really protecting is not a politician's privacy. What they really want protected is their hypocrisy, and that's why I think it's perfectly okay to write about it.
Now, you resigned over this.
Well, office politics always sounds a little ridiculous in retrospect. It had to do more with I am not the owner of the magazine, and I actually feel very strongly that capitalism is capitalism. If the owner gets to decide in the end, and I don't have any problem with that. Every week there are things in the New Republic that if I were really running the show, I wouldn't publish, even though I am the editor. And that's fine. And there are things which the editor-in-chief and owner puts in because of me that he wouldn't publish if he had his way completely. My problem there was I felt that it was a matter of cowardice, not a matter of principled disagreement. But, you know, you get older. I don't know if I would I may not have the same principles today I had back then. Maybe I've sold out. Who knows?
Do you think we're going to have any Democrats running for president?
Oh, I think, I was very glad to see this little episode over Judge Ginsburg and the marijuana, in part because I thought it was about time a conservative got the same kind of treatment from the press that liberals have been getting. Sort of small things blown out of proportion and cause them to withdraw. Sure, no, I think, look, in the next few months, most of the candidates in both parties are going to be eliminated one way or another. That's not anything abnormal. That's democracy. And in the end, there will be one candidate from either party.
Did you get a good laugh, so to speak, from the Just Say No administration trying to appoint a judge who had confess to smoking marijuana a couple of times?
Well, I think what gave me the best laugh was the sight of President Reagan and Senator Orrin Hatch and other conservatives during that brief period before they pushed him overboard saying, well, what's the big deal? So he smoked a little grass back in the or he experimented with marijuana, which is the way they put it, back in the 60s and 70s. It shouldn't be held against him now. It was a youthful indiscretion, all of which is perfectly true, but it's not the kind of thing you hear them saying ordinarily.
In one of your columns, you wrote, as conservatives discover judicial activism, liberals may discover judicial restraints. And you say in one of your columns that you think the judges that Reagan has tried to get appointed so far is a case of the chickens coming home to roost for liberals who support Roe versus Wade, who supported that kind of constitutional activism.
Well, for the past two or three decades, since 1954, it's been sort of an anomalous situation. You had judges imposing liberal social policy through the courts. I support most of those decisions. Some of them I have a problem with. Roe v. Wade, the abortion decision, is one of them. I believe in a woman's right to choose abortion. I don't believe it's in the Constitution. And I think it's very dangerous to get addicted to having judges do your political work for you, as liberals have done, for the precise reason that you're going to have a conservative judiciary, or very well could someday. Reagan has appointed an enormous number of judges. Now, Reagan and the conservatives claim that they believe in judicial restraint. They think judges should interpret the Constitution narrowly, should not be making social policy in the name of constitutional interpretation. However, naturally, they believe that when they're trying to oppose the liberal judges who've been doing that. When you have a conservative majority in the judiciary, you could well see conservatives doing exactly what liberals were doing. And in fact, that has happened. In the early part of the century, for several decades, the conservative judiciary, and judges naturally come from the upper class and upper middle class and do tend to be conservative as a matter of social distinction. In those days, judges overturned worker health and safety laws all under the rubric of freedom of contract, which they claim to find in the Constitution. So it's a kind of judicial arrogance that can boomerang. And what we know about Judge Ginsburg, which is not very much, I think that might have been a serious problem with him.
Michael Kinsley is my guest. He's the editor of The New Republic and author of a new collection of essays titled Curse of the Giant Muffins. I want to talk a little bit about your life and your career. You've written, "My adult life began when I arrived at an elite Eastern university from the Midwest as a second-generation American-born ethnic Jewish. And after 70 years of climbing by three generations, I was poised for a final assault on respectability." Well, what exactly was the nature of your assault on respectability?
Well, that was in a piece I was talking about the various forms of social snobbery and arguing that in our society, and it's really a compliment to our society, reverse snobbery is much more common than normal snobbery. What I went on to say in that article is, in the world of the Eastern elite, as described by Henry James and Edith Wharton, a person like that, like such as myself, would feel oppressed by snobbery at every turn. But I think this American society is democratic enough that I'd never felt it. On the other hand, there are occasions when people put on great airs of reverse snobbery.
I know that's what you were talking about, but let me ask you again about your assault on respectability.
Well, I guess I don't know. Someone else will have to judge whether I've managed to climb the peaks of respectability.
No, but you said you were trying to assault it. I was curious what you did back in the days when you were assaulting respectability.
That was just a joke. Don't force me into a corner on that one.
Okay. Did you get politically radical, though? Culturally radical?
Everyone always says this, and I say it too. I think my politics are just about the same as they were back then. Back then, in the late 60s, early 70s, and during the middle of the anti-Vietnam movement and so on, I was considered sort of a reactionary because I was only against the war and wasn't against all aspects of American society. And now the pendulum has swung so far that I'm more or less where I am and I'm considered fairly far left. No, I was sort of a reactionary in the mood of those days.
You're perhaps one of the only or one of the few people who's actually defended yuppies in print.
Well, don't you feel a little sorrier for them now than you did a few months ago?
Do you mean since the crash?
Since the crash, sure. They're now called, we have a piece in the New Republic this week about puppies, previously upward professionals.
You've written a book, and you're someone who's written that nobody really reads books anymore. All they do is they read the reviews of the book, but in the interest of sounding really smart and intellectual, they say that they actually read the book. Is this going to be the fate of your book, do you think?
Well, I sort of hope this book, in a way, is the equivalent of fast food. You've got lots of little, none of the pieces in it is longer than three or four pages. So I have to hope more people will read it. Of course, I'm really interested in people buying it. I don't really care whether they read it or not. I got a book that came into our reviewing department yesterday that I'm sure is a perfect example of my thesis that people buy books and don't read them. It was this big, thick book called Perestroika by Mikhail Gorbachev. And it's one of the big books of the fall season, and thousands and thousands of copies are being printed and no doubt will be bought. And I'll just bet you nobody actually sits down and reads it. At least I'm not going to, are you?
Oh. You said in one of your pieces that to test if people actually read the books that they said they'd read, you distributed several hundred books with a note inserted into the middle of the book saying, did you really do that?
Oh, we absolutely did that.
Explain what you did.
We took those little yellow stick 'em things, you know, that pad, little notes, little stick-em notes, and stamped on them. If you see this note, call the New Republic. We put the phone number, and we'll give you $5. And we put them about three-quarters of the way to the end of a bunch of what were then best-selling nonfiction books in various Washington bookstores. And several hundred is an exaggeration. I can't remember the exact number, maybe about 100. And the point was, you would never come across this note unless you actually turned that page. It wouldn't fall out of the book or anything like that. And we did not get a single response. Now, it could be that people would see this and laugh it off, or it could be the note would fall off, or it could be that the book wasn't bought, even though we did it at the books at the top of the pile, and these were books that were selling well. There's any number of explanations that would explain if you only got two or three, but to get no responses at all, I thought was sort of revealing.
Are you in the middle of writing a TRB column now?
No, thank goodness. I wrote mine a couple days ago.
What was it about?
Well, this was the one about the problems with the budget, where I came within a quarter of an inch of a plea for leadership, but pulled back from the edge of the abyss in the nick of time.
One of the things that I think you're very well known for as a writer is your sense of humor. Did you ever want to be a humorist? You are, in a way, a humorist, because most of your pieces are humorous pieces. But did you ever just want to write comedy?
Well, I don't know. Art Buchwald has the most successful political columnist in America. So, sure, it's something to think about. Some of the negative reviews of this book in conservative publications have sort of taken the line that this guy's just a jokester, and isn't it a sad commentary on American liberalism that this jokester is taken seriously? I think I'm more than a jokester, but I do think that jokes are important. I mean, not just for their own sake, but it's important in trying to describe the world in general, and certainly the world of politics in particular, to keep in mind that a lot of what goes on is completely ridiculous. And the only way you can really make that point is by being humorous about it.
Well, Michael Kinsley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Michael Kinsley. He's the editor of The New Republic and writes the syndicated TRB column. His columns have been collected into a new book titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. It's published by Summit Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.